Yes, of course, look at the headline numbers, but then look at what happens because of those numbers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 14th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a couple of stories about second-order effects. What happens after the news happens? News item number one today, another 3 million people, as I'm sure you've heard, made first-time claims for unemployment in the past week. That brings it to 36 million plus in the past couple of months. There's a whole slew of second-order effects out of that, of course, and one of them is that the Labor Department has told cities and states they have an obligation to detect waste and fraud in the unemployment system, and there are reports of states that have been pushing companies to disclose when employees refuse to return to work. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, that is putting a whole lot of businesses in a pretty tight spot.
About 2 weeks ago, the Vermont Labor Department launched a webpage for businesses to report employees who decline offers to return to work. By doing so, employers could effectively kick those workers off of unemployment insurance, though there are some exemptions. Mark Fryer co-owns a restaurant called The Reservoir in Waterbury, Vermont. He says he isn't happy with the tough choices that may force him to make.
It makes it very difficult to think that we would have to turn to the state and tell them that they should pull their aid.
Fryer laid off all of his employees in mid-March. He also took out a Paycheck Protection Program loan, which can be forgiven if he brings his headcount back up during the loan's 8-week window. Restaurants are allowed to do takeout, but Vermont hasn't allowed them to fully reopen. Fryer's restaurant is closed.
We're not rushing to bring people off unemployment when we can't reopen our doors because of state order.
One of Fryer's former employees is Sage Guggenheim, head chef at The Reservoir. She says she'd love to get back, but given the safety issues of returning to work, she understands that others want to stay at home.
We don't want to force people into a difficult position where they have to choose between what they want to do and what they have to do.
Businesses want to keep good relationships with their employees, says labor economist Teresa Ghilarducci at the New School.
They also have some loyalty and a relationship of trust that builds up over time.
Several other states have set up similar websites for reporting employees, including Montana, Oklahoma, Tennessee, and South Carolina. Frank Knapp is the president of the South Carolina Chamber of Commerce. He says many businesses are realizing a hard truth about their PPP loans.
This forgivable loan may not be forgivable.
He says some may decide to give back their PPP loans rather than force their employees to return to work. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
News item number two today and the second order effects therefrom come to us from Kimberly Adams. She reported yesterday, you might remember, on companies that help businesses that go out of business auction off their assets. And she was telling us how those auctioneers are getting busier and busier. So today, the next logical step in that story, given just for instance, today's unemployment numbers, the coming wave of bankruptcy filings. Here's Kimberly.
There are several different kinds of bankruptcies, Chapter 7, 11, 13, each one a different strategy of what to do when businesses or individuals can no longer pay the bills. Amy Quackenboss is with the American Bankruptcy Institute.
We certainly expect that filings will increase depending upon how long the country is going to be on lockdown and how long the COVID-19 pandemic lasts.
In April, Chapter 11 bankruptcies, which allow businesses to reorganize so they can try to survive, were up 26% from last year. Sarah Sternberg-Green at Duke Law says this is just the beginning.
We will see some who just decide they can't survive and they'll file Chapter 7, which is liquidation.
For now, Chapter 13 consumer bankruptcies are down. People are spending their savings in relief checks, says Ed Boltz, a bankruptcy attorney in North Carolina. He says in normal times, three things cause bankruptcies: job loss, sickness, and divorce. And with the pandemic,
we've got two out of the three already hitting, and who knows what staying at home is going to do to relationships and marriages also.
But while a bankruptcy can wreck your credit and be a very stressful experience, it can also provide an important backstop for the economy, says Matt Notowadigdo, an economics professor at MIT.
One of the things the bankruptcy system does is it allows people to get a fresh start and then try to resume somewhat back to their old path of spending.
That includes spending on the bankruptcy itself. Lawyers and fees can add up quickly, and Notobedigdo warns that consumers who are in trouble may have to save up so they can afford bankruptcy. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street started today the way you'd think it'd start, with millions more people out of work. Then traders remembered they're not paying attention to the real economy anyway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's going to come a point, I suppose, where people are just going to stop hearing all the bad economic news. Self-preservation or information overload or I don't know what, honestly. One hopes, though, that that day is not today. This morning's unemployment claims we talked about a minute ago. Tomorrow, we're going to get the April number on retail sales. And remember, we were already pulling back in March when the lockdowns were just getting started, and April is likely to be worse. Not everybody has lost their jobs, of course, and even those who have haven't stopped shopping completely. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, we are shopping differently now.
Americans are spending less right now, and more of what they're buying is being purchased at the click of a mouse. The Marketplace Edison research poll finds that 4 in 10 consumers who were already shopping online for groceries or other goods are now doing it more.
I would definitely say it has increased for sure.
David Blevins lives in Clarksville, Tennessee, with his wife and 3 kids. He owns a Chick-fil-A franchise that's been open and busier than ever since the pandemic hit. He says shopping in person right now,
it's a hassle. Even if they're not open, stores have limited hours.
Whereas shopping online,
you don't have to get out of the house. You know, my wife's trying to stay in the house with the kids as much as possible. Driving her crazy, actually.
The rise in online shopping is likely to persist post-pandemic, says Camilla Yanishevsky at CFRA Research.
The survey data says that even when the stay-at-home orders are lifted, people still want to avoid public places.
She says there's no checkout counter with tempting goods at an online store, and it's easy to compare prices.
It allows the consumer to be more frugal.
And frugality is a high priority right now, says Columbia economist Robert Farocnia. He's looked at how low- and middle-income families are spending their government stimulus checks.
On food and pharmacies and supermarkets and so on.
But according to the Marketplace Edison research poll, those making less than $25,000 a year are the least likely to shop online. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Let's say you're a hacker, one of the bad guys, and ransomware is your specialty. This might seem an opportune moment, should you be in the hacking business, for you to hit a whole industry that is otherwise distracted by a global pandemic. And in fact, hospitals in Colorado, Germany, and the Czech Republic have all been hit by ransomware attacks. And everybody from the U.S. and British governments to Interpol is saying there are going to be more. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on that story.
Say you run a hospital. Hackers break into your network and they steal your patient records. You know, who has COVID-19 and how you're trying to keep them alive. The bad guys say they'll give your data back if you pay. What do you do?
These cyber criminals are very financially motivated.
Charity Wright watches cyber threats at the security firm Insights. She says many hospitals are overwhelmed in the pandemic, so ransomware attackers have leverage.
They don't follow the same moral codes and values that some of us do.
How do they do it? First, they find targets. Ever since an attack 4 years ago against Hollywood Presbyterian Hospital in California reportedly yielded $17,000, lots of hospitals have been preyed on. One main reason? Many run obsolete, insecure versions of Windows that are no longer supported by Microsoft. Healthcare data expert Sung Choi teaches at the University of Central Florida.
Healthcare tends to lag behind the financial industry and the tech industry when it comes to cybersecurity.
Teaching hospitals in particular have busy residents coming and going, so lots of enticing passwords to hack.
And also, teaching hospitals tend to be larger hospitals, which means more patients, more data to steal.
Then there's getting into a network. One way is to trick a person on the inside of the target company to click a malicious link, say in an email that appears to be from the boss, says Charity Wright.
Now, if your CEO emails you and says, hey, I need you to do me a favor, a lot of people are distracted. They're clicking on those links a lot more than normal.
Fake websites also work to lure people. A current one is a dead ringer for the world COVID map from Johns Hopkins.
And it looks just like the real one, but it actually takes you to a malicious website.
Once the hackers get in, they move about the network and then lock up data and then leave ransom notes. Here, Charity Wright reads one from an attack on the Champaign-Urbana public health system in Illinois from March.
Right now, this is what's happening to your computer, but also your heart rate has probably increased because you're scared. You don't know how to turn it off. We recommend you step away and just let the malware do what it wants to do.
The hackers demanded $300,000 and they got it. Typically, when the bad guys demand money, law enforcement officials say don't pay. It just rewards the crooks. But Bill Siegel, who runs the ransomware response company Coveware, says not paying and losing your data can force companies to shut down. And that's the dilemma for an executive.
I may have to close my business down and lay off my longtime employees and lose my health care. Or I have to, pinch my nose and deal with these cyber criminals and potentially pay them.
Siegel is often hired to negotiate with the digital hostage takers.
We don't really go into our negotiation tactics because we know that the bad guys will probably listen to this and we don't want to give them any sort of edge.
What's clear, he says, is there are a lot of bad guys and they don't even have to be cyber geniuses. They can just go to the dark web.
The actual ransomware kits, those can be purchased off the shelf. There's a developer that sells you that kit and you split the proceeds.
The attackers are always innovating with new ways to extort money. So no one thinks the attacks on hospitals will be going away. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
When you get here, you call us. We suit up in our masks and rubber gloves and come out and put it in your trunk so there's no contact.
Just another day on the job for a librarian. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so here you go. The blue chips were down 400 at one point today and yet closed up 377, did the Dow Jones Industrial Average, 1.6%, 23,625. The NASDAQ added 80 points, 0.9%, 89.43. The S&P 500 advanced 32 points, 1.1%, ended at 28.52. Financial stocks led the comeback. Bank of America climbed 4%. J.P. Morgan Chase packed on 4.1% today. MasterCard lifted 3%. The company said it's seeing a small rebound in credit card use as restrictions are eased. 3M lost about a 0.1% today. The company reported a drop in sales last month, a spike in demand for face masks apparently. Not enough to make up for declining sales in some other categories like electronics and industrial products. In other news, 3M makes electronics. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Not to put too fine a point on it, but as we head into max college graduation season, what the ceremonies are going to look like, virtual, socially distant, or not at all, is really the least of the graduates' worries. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes a look at what's ahead for the class of 2020.
2020 started off so well for so many rising seniors.
I was supposed to be a sales associate at a restaurant software company.
My plan was to spend the entire summer working in a restaurant and saving up money to relocate to Los Angeles.
Liam Modesti is graduating from Wake Forest in North Carolina. He's a business development major. Meg Schimmelfenny is a film major at Kenyon College in Ohio. The pandemic has basically eviscerated their plans.
HR called me and says they're suspending all hires until further notice.
I'm very worried about moving out to LA before there's a vaccine.
The numbers show a mixed picture so far. According to a survey done in April by the National Association of Colleges and Employers, only 4% of companies had revoked job offers, but 19% were thinking about it. 22% of employers were revoking internship offers. Internships often lead to jobs. Edwin Koch is director of research for NACE.
Until the economy shows real signs of life, it's going to be hard for a student that's entering the job market right at this point to get a job right away.
That's borne out by an April poll by Challenger Grain Christmas showing 37% of companies have instituted a hiring freeze. Andy Challenger is senior vice president.
There's a whole second wave of companies that are now facing a global recession that are considering how they're going to reduce their labor force.
And he says 2020 grads are now facing a whole lot of extra competition.
Now they are competing for those entry-level jobs among 30, 35 million Americans with working experience.
Students who graduated into previous recessions carried the consequences with them for years. Till von Wachter is professor of economics at UCLA. He studied how things go for recession grads from both high school and college.
Workers entering the labor market during the recession fare initially worse than their more lucky peers that graduated in economic expansion.
Recession grads make less money. It takes 10 to 15 years to catch up in terms of income. Workers who graduated during the early 80s recession ended up making less in their 40s and 50s as well. Now, it is not at all clear the extent to which 2020 is like other recessions. Things may go very differently. We don't know.
I don't want students kind of giving into this gloom and doom and thinking, well, there's nothing I can do now. That's the absolute worst thing they could do.
Mark Smith is Dean of Career Services at Washington University in St. Louis. He's been advising his grads full tilt. He tells them there are jobs out there, and many of those lost may reappear, though they may be different from what students were expecting. He says grads should still be applying.
And that might be 25% of their time. But then I want them spending 75% of their time networking with people who are doing the kinds of things that interest them.
He says a lot of people have a lot of time and a lot of sympathy for recent grads, so it's a good time to reach out. And if all else fails, volunteer, take an online class, write a blog.
If you're not doing anything, you're definitely not going to get something.
He worries most, though, about students who don't have the luxury of waiting around, who need to work now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
This was to have been, in the before times, a big week for TV, with the networks rolling out their fall lineups and advertisers buying up commercial time. But with television production now impeded at best, all bets are off, right? And that goes for unscripted shows as well, because how do you make reality TV when reality is so unreal? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looked into that one for us.
On the most recent episode of American Idol, contestant Louis Knight sang on his porch to a live audience of one, his mom. The judges were there too, but virtually, watching through little boxes that look like a Zoom call.
Yeah, man.
Love you, man.
Yeah, man. Way to go.
Survivor, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, and The Real Housewives of Atlanta are also producing shows remotely. Tom Noonan is a professor at the School of Theater, Film, and Television at UCLA.
It's going to look a lot more DIY. You're not going to see your favorite celebrities or personalities lit or made up, but that may be part of the charm of this.
But how long can this charm last? Shows that document people's lives could clash with the harsh reality of the pandemic. like Bravo's Vanderpump Rules, a social drama set in an LA restaurant, or The Amazing Race, which is all about travel. Chris Sanders is an executive producer at Atlantic TV, a production company which works with NBC and the Discovery Channel.
I mean, the reality right now would be everybody in front of the camera has a mask on.
Shows that could thrive are the kind that happen in a bubble. You know, where you throw a bunch of people together for a social experiment. Think Big Brother or Netflix's Love is Blind.
You basically got to create an environment that is going to be safe. So we probably will be seeing, you know, more of these kind of closed environment scenarios.
And watching people whose biggest worries are a love triangle or being voted off an island could give audiences a break from actual reality. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This pandemic is forcing a lot of businesses not only to rethink their business models, but in a way to rethink their basic value proposition, what they offer better than anybody else. That's a situation familiar to public libraries, which over the last 20 years or so have had to become more than just a place to borrow books, and which now are facing the same kind of challenges a lot of other businesses are. Jennifer Pearson is on the phone. She's the director of the Marshall County Memorial Library in Marshall County, Tennessee. She is also, by the way, the president of the Association for Rural and Small Libraries. Jennifer, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So your doors are closed right now at the library, but I imagine you're still involved in your community somehow. Tell us about that.
That's right. We made the choice to close the doors about 9 weeks ago. What we've been doing since then is a lot of online content, even more so than we did before. We've been doing online story times and online meetings. We just started a curbside delivery. So you can call us or put something on reserve in the library catalog or send us an email and we will choose some books for you. We'll put them in a container. When you get here, you call us. We suit up in our masks and rubber gloves and come out and put it in your trunk so there's no contact.
Man, that's great. I imagine the parents of younger children who are working from home are loving that online story time thing.
They do. They do. And it's interesting. We've seen our social media statistics go through the roof. And I think that's good for us. And I think it might even get more people in the library once we're able to open again.
The one of the defining characteristics of the 2008 crisis, certainly in my reporting, when I would go out and talk to people in like 2008, 2009, who had lost their jobs and really had nowhere to go, was that they would go to libraries to job hunt, to use the computers and the facilities and especially the Wi-Fi. Do you imagine that's something that's happening now? I mean, are people pulling up and using the Wi-Fi and do you expect people to use your services sort of as an employment thing as this crisis continues?
Yes, absolutely. They are currently using the Wi-Fi outside to do those things. The first thing we will open to the public for, and that should happen next Monday unless numbers tell a different story, is that we'll open some of our public computers so that those people can come in and do exactly what you're talking about. Fill out job applications, write resumes. It's also tax season. A lot of people need us to file their taxes. And we need more people to fill out the census, and they can do that online here once we open up.
Once we do open, and this is sort of a larger kind of macroeconomic question, right? So many things are going to be changed, at least in the short term. How do you expect libraries are going to change as we get going again after this crisis?
That's such an interesting question, and for the last 15 or 20 years, public libraries have really reinvented themselves, and they are a place to come and stay. It's not just take a book, leave a book. I think people who make the rules don't understand what libraries are necessarily. So there have been a lot of rules and guidelines, in our state at least, for small businesses and restaurants and gyms. But I would compare us more to schools in terms of what happens here and the number of people who are in and out. So it's hard to compare the guidelines they've written for other businesses and say, okay, we can just adopt these for ourselves.
Right. Jennifer Pearson is the director of the Marshall County Memorial Library in Tennessee, also the president of the Association for Rural and Small Libraries. Ms. Pearson, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, a glimpse into what we've been doing with ourselves as we have been quarantined. This data is from the market research firm NPD Group. They track purchases of a bunch of home and kitchen goods. The sale of electric pasta makers, up 462%. Water filtration machines and air purifiers, you kind of get this one, it's up about 150%. Also, bread makers, for all y'all out there, up something like 600%. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context for the day. Kind of a coda, if you will, the Supreme story about college graduations. The Federal Reserve is out with a survey today, officially titled Report on the Economic Well-being of U.S. Households in 2019, featuring supplemental data from April 2020. Yes, a mouthful, but here's why I mention it. The Fed says 63% of workers with a college degree could fully work from home in the month of March. Just 20% of workers with high school diplomas or less could do the same thing. All right, we're off. Amir Bibawe, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.